people who love them.
Hello, my friends. This is Mickey Desai. We're doing the Zoom thing because this is the first recording we've ever made during pandemic. And at the table, we have... Well, who should I...
How are you going to point to us to let us know?
Becca, that was Becca. And our, and as usual, we have...
Ben.
Right. And I don't know if we should do this one on video or not. I mean, we've never actually done a real-time video release that coincided with the podcast release, but...
I'm grunge girl over here. I don't know about video. I'm sitting in here. I know you can't even see my shirt, but you know, I've got my taco t-shirt on and
what's the rattling noise?
I'm doing my medications. That's why when you started introducing, I went like this to let you know I wasn't touching them right now. And that means I can't continue them either. Hold on.
So we were supposed while you want me to mute you?
Well, hold on. Time out. Let me just shove these in here and put that there, and I'm good, and I won't rattle them.
Let's visit your auto advocate.
No, this is great. So in a nutshell, Ray is our auto advocate. Ray's been in the business for 42 years, and I hope you've been enjoying the segments we've done so far. Ray, one real quick question for you today. You know, we've talked in the past about dealer markup, and that it's really, in the grand scheme of things, not that much of a markup. So how do car dealerships make their money?
Well, the truth be told, the way dealerships make their money today is in parts and service and finance and pre-owned car sales. New car sales are a loser for most dealerships. Used car sales are a profit center. Finance and insurance is a profit center. And parts and service. I will tell you that dealers love warranty work. One of the greatest experiences I ever had when I was with an Acura dealership was when Acura had an issue with transmissions and they recalled I don't know how many cars to have transmissions replaced. And we had like the best 2, 3, 4 months ever because we were replacing 3, 4, 5 transmissions a week. Mm-hmm. And well, the factory pays full pop for that. And so that's where a dealership makes money. What most people don't realize is service departments are responsible for what we call service absorption in the business. And that is to try and produce 70% of the money it takes to cover 70% of all expenses in the dealership. And then sales and finance are to cover the rest. Well, I've worked in some dealerships where service absorption was 100, 105%, which means we were making a profit at the end of the year just based off of service and parts so that any cars that got sold were just a plus.
Wow.
Yes. So that's where dealerships make money. It's new and used car sales, new car not so much, finance and insurance, parts and service.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, again, a lot to unpack there, but getting in the interest of time, should I be hesitant to go to a dealership for repairs? I mean, there's a lot of concern about what dealers look at in terms of how they evaluate your car and telling you to do work that you don't necessarily need to do and things like that.
Well, I will tell you this, that the way the way pay plans are designed for your service advisors is one that encourages service advisors to upsell customers on things that they may or may not need. So truth be told, that's going to be anywhere, whether you're at an independent shop or whether you're at a dealership.
I realize it's a loaded question. And the reason I ask that is because I think the end result is it still pays to have some basic knowledge about your car and what may or may not need to be done to it.
It's no different than going to a doctor. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're better off getting a second opinion.
Yeah.
And let them know that. I know of a situation where my daughter on her car, every time she would take it to the dealership, the guy kept telling her she needed tires, whether she drove 2,000 miles since the last time or 10,000 miles. She didn't need tires. He needed the sale.
Right.
So, you know, I sent her for a second opinion. It turned out she didn't need tires.
Good stuff. Yeah. Well, now we know how a car dealership really makes their money, and I don't actually begrudge them that. You know, everybody needs to make a living, but sometimes it just seems a little more. It seems a little more unsavory than it should. I guess I don't know if that's the right. I don't know if that's a fair term.
I don't know if it's a fair term, but I think it's a legitimate term. We have in the industry. The industry has fostered that image over, well, I don't know, the last 100-plus years
right.
of selling and servicing cars. So there's a distrust, and it's hard to build trust.
Good stuff. As always, how does a listener find you?
Go to yourautoadvocate.com, yourautoadvocate.com. You'll get right to me. Hopefully, we can help you in some way.
Awesome. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Mickey. Once again, a pleasure chatting with you.
But how are you guys doing as long as we're together here on mic and recording? How's pandemic been treating you?
Oh, pretty well, really.
Yeah.
I'm going star crazy. I should say crazier.
Right.
Star crazy. I have kids, and anybody yeah. who has kids knows that during the pandemic, they talk about how the schools were closed, but it actually made every child a homeschool student. So being stuck in a house 24/7 with two 10-year-olds with ADHD and ODD and trying to homeschool them, it's
challenging.
That's one way to put it, yes.
Yeah.
Mom's gonna start drinking a lot.
So Ben, you're at home. You're not traveling like you usually are for the last couple weeks, right?
No, not much. I've done very little in the way of customer visits. I did do a road trip all the way to Illinois. I think it was last week. Mm-hmm. And I've got some that'll be just, you know, day trips coming up this coming week.
Yep. And in case the listener's wondering, I'm actually job hunting. So, and, you know, just like I was before, except the job hunt has gotten a whole lot worse or a whole lot more difficult. Let's just say that. But it is what it is. But we're here to talk about cars. And on the list today, I have a couple things. One is that some time ago, we had commented that Ford was going to be discontinuing its V8s. And at that time, we kind of said, we kind of stated it in a way that made it sound like they were just stopping V8 production altogether. And apparently, that's not true. They're keeping V8s. And yet they're decreasing. They're not putting them out as hard as they used to. And they're not putting them in all the vehicles that they used to.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly the article. I remember our discussion about it. I just don't remember exactly the article and how they had worded it.
Right.
But obviously, for me, that's a huge concern.
Well, you want the V8 in your Mustang, which I think is still going to be possible. And you're right. It would be such a mistake if they discontinued a V8 Mustang. But what I'm reading here, it says that demand for V8 engines is actually decreasing and that they're replacing V8 production in their trucks with many V6 engines, which do just as well as their V8 predecessor.
Oh, well, I'd want to see the numbers, not just on horsepower and things like that. But when you talk about the trucks, the torque, the pulling capacity, all of that, they've got some pretty big rivals. I have a hard time imagining the trucks without V8s and obviously the Mustangs without V8s. Although I've pretty much written off any new car. I think I've had various rants here and there. I'm just pretty much sticking to old cars at this point. But still.
Yeah, I think in theory it could be completely workable, because not only are engines getting so much better, but with all these, you know, very well controlled transmissions with a million gears in them now, it should still be able to do the job. You know, today's V6 is probably twice as good as yesterday's V8.
More gears are just more gears to fail. I'm sorry, the whole planetary gear system, one little thing goes wrong, one little pressure issue or something. It just,
well, they're working so far.
I understand it. They're becoming better. It just, all I can see is more things to go wrong.
Well, I mean, isn't that just the case with everything, though? I mean, you know, look at an engine from a 1950s era Volvo and compare it to today's Volvo engine, and there's no resemblance whatsoever.
Yeah. A lot of the causes of failure are going away, or not going away, but I mean, you know, being reduced. You know, the metallurgy is becoming so good now. You know, the way things wear is very differently. The tolerances are all so much finer. Everything's better now. So, failures are, I believe, going down. Now, long-term durability, who's to say? But, you know, these, nothing's built to last forever. You know, they, if they sell one to you every 5 years, they're happy.
Yeah, but now we've got cars that people can hack, though. I mean, think about that. We didn't, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you couldn't hack a car, and now there's cars that can be hacked.
Well, now I think we're talking about two issues. We're talking about the actual physical element of making an engine perform better than any of its larger displacing predecessors. And then there's the technological side of what it means to run a car, which is not quite the same as, you know.
Right.
A gear breaking is not the same as someone unlocking and locking your doors for you.
Well, no. We've talked about the various stories of cars actually being controlled remotely as far as driving, and cars are heading in that direction. But also car performance could mean different things to different people. Mm-hmm. Car performance might mean to one person the fastest 0 to 60, great on the racetrack, that kind of thing, where my idea might be my 23-year-old Mustang that's still running. You know, it's going to be different things to different people.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. And on the other side of that is the hackability issue. Is on the one hand, yeah, we should build things with a little more security in them and maybe not technologize things so much. I would be in favor of that. But there's a part of me that also thinks that we're looking at the tools that are actually improving the driving experience for some people.
But those tools are
being misused by other folks. So it's like, do we allow ourselves to have the refinements of technology because it improves our experience, or do we find a way to crack down on the trolls out there who are going to try to misuse the tools just because they want to have fun with my lock system?
Get rid of these trolls and more will follow.
Right.
And if you get security to lock people out, they'll find a way around it. That is just how it's been with computer systems.
Yeah.
And that's how it will be with the ones that are integrated into cars. What I do with my older ones is I just pick and choose what I want integrated. I work it into the car, and it's not a part of a system that can be dialed into.
Right.
You would have to literally be sitting there in the car to hack it.
Well, can you imagine being a criminal, and one day you wake up and you get into your highly technologized car, and all of a sudden the doors lock and the autopilot takes over, and the next thing you know, you're sitting in front of the police station.
That's karma.
The police can take over your car and bring you in, right?
Right. The karma of cars with technology. I don't know. That reminds me, on a side note, when we're done with that one.
Yeah.
Potential car-related question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. I didn't know if we were done with that topic.
Oh, I think we're done. We can come. You know, we're never that strict, are we?
No, not so much.
Yeah,
we've tried to be a little less ADHD with with topics. No, that's something that had crossed my mind. So my Mustang is 23 model years old now, but it was released from the factory in 96. So let's see, this time next year she'll be 24 model years old. The question that's going through my mind is, once a car is 25 years old, you no longer have to do emissions in the state of Georgia.
Right.
And I'm wondering where that line exactly is drawn, and if they mean, how is that running through my head now? Is it after it turns 25? Because technically, not next year, but the one after, the car will be 25 years old, but 24 model years old.
Yeah, no, I think that if you can go into the tag office and say, my car is now 25 years old, and that's what counts. But I'm sure the Department of Revenue would be happy to confirm this for you.
I think it's right at 25. At least that's what it was in my experience with the first Lotus I had. It was a 1986 model, and I bought it in 2010. And I had to have an emissions check when I registered it, but then the following year I did not.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Mustang is a 97, but like all car, well, you know, they're always released at the end of the previous year. She was released from factory in 96.
But no, I don't think they care about that. I think they care about the year on the title.
I would rather them go by the production one.
Yes, but... You don't
that
think
makes
like
things
the
complicated. Yeah, that makes things complicated.
For them, You know how tedious it is making sure a 25-year-old car can pass emissions?
What's that Star Trek quote? Never underestimate the something power of a bureaucracy. There are two constants in the world, bureaucracy and something else. I can't remember what it is. But, but I think it is the 25th year and not the actual 26th year.
But the 25th as far as model years.
Yeah, right.
You always have to separate the model year from production year.
Is that the gripe you would put on the agenda?
No, the gripe I was talking about was the negative battery clamp.
Oh.
Because like I said, sometimes it can be very difficult getting, or it just, and this isn't an emissions part. This is just a part of keeping the car going. And some of it is my fault. But every year I have to scramble and make sure that the car is up and ready and emissions compliant and everything is peachy. And with the exception of the year that the Pontiac totally failed, I generally don't drive the Mustang a whole lot. So this year with the whole pandemic and the shelter in place, quarantine, all this other stuff, it wasn't until the last minute that I realized, I can still pay for my tag online. I was thinking the office is going to be closed because right. I always go down to the tag office. And that occurred to me last minute. And I've known for a while that the battery clamps needed to be replaced. They are the original clamps and all that that came with her. And finally, after all of these years, they were starting to show signs of rust. I've done a really good job keeping everything clean and corrosion free, but metal will age. But I had been ignoring that simple task in going more for the bigger, more complicated things. So it finally came back to bite me this year. And I just needed to pull the battery out of the car. And the negative battery clamp was stuck.
Oh my.
And I don't mean just a little stuck. And then just to add to it, the socket that I had put on the bolt to remove the bolt is now stuck. I don't know how it happened. I didn't realize iron would act like super glue, or not iron, but the rust would act like super glue. I have no idea what happened. I can't get it off, not with vice grips or anything. But then the problem became having to cut off. But yeah, I mean, first you got to remove it from the battery to even start doing some of this, but to cut off the negative battery clamp and with the way that it's wired up, it's got two additional grounds leading directly out of the clamp. If you ever go to the auto parts store and you look at their ready-made clamp replacement, they generally have just the one negative battery cable. There are some that will have an additional ground lead coming out of there. I need two right out of the clamp.
So you finally cut the thing off?
I did finally cut the thing off. But obviously I have to do a create my own since I need those the two negative. Ford loves grounding things into the chassis. I've got two negative leads coming off directly at the clamp. It was going to have to be a rather precise cut just because a lot of that wire would have to be special order. I can go get one of those ready-made clamps and just cut out a section of what I need. The additional leads are not 0 to 2 gauge. They're more along the lines of maybe 4 to 6 gauge. Mm-hmm. So those would all be special order. I have learned in the past, you cannot go down to your local auto parts store and find that kind of gauge wire. But I did luck out. I went to Harbor Freight. And I found what turned out to be these amazing cable cutters. And everybody I have said this to that aren't necessarily my car friends, they just, they have nothing to say. It's weird, but I talk about how it cut through it like it was butter. Zero nice. Gauge, and this pair of cable cutters just went right through it. Fabulous. Awesome. I should have written down the brand name. They've got red handles and,
Harbor Freight is free to give us a sponsorship if they want to.
That is true. Yeah. And I have a lot of stuff from Harbor Freight.
So, if we have any contacts with Harbor Freight, we would love to talk to you guys.
Definitely. But that's something we need to look into.
We definitely need to look into that. Well, I hope you got it all sorted out. Did you get the washer removed and all that business, or does it matter anymore?
The washer part doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And since I didn't go into that, what the failure is on the clamp, there's some various different types of clamps, but this is like one piece of metal that just wraps around and comes back over to the cable, and there's a bolt going through it. And I guess I had always just assumed in my mind that that was a nut in the back that was soldered into place. I'm now looking at it and calling it the fat washer that Ford apparently just super glued into place.
Right.
Because that's all it is. It's not a rounded out bolt. It is round. Looking at the positive side, yes, it's meant to be stuck in place, but there is no sign of any soldering whatsoever on it. But the bolt with the rust, it got into the thread. And so the bolt is stuck to this washer that has now come loose from the clamp. So it's just spinning. And they have, beveled isn't quite the right word, but wrapped the part of the metal that goes around the terminal over it. I don't know how to make it prettier or safer or what have you. But trying to peel that away to get to the washer is proving impossible. So I've cut it off.
Yeah, no, we need to get pictures of that online at some point if you have the wherewithal to still take them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got the clamp still. It's just been decapitated.
Yeah. No. You know what we forgot to do?
What's that?
Grand Trivia Auto.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Trivia.
So I'm looking at my old notes, and I'm going to ask you to tell me if we've done this question before, because normally I mark them as being done, and this one's not marked, and yet it rings a huge bell.
That's happened before.
It's happened before. It could just be me getting old along with my need for reading glasses. I need, like, I don't know, Prevagen or something for my brain. But the question is, what kind of car inspired Ferruccio Lamborghini to start his own automobile company? Because before, you may remember, they were simply a tractor company.
Right.
And so what kind of car inspired Ferruccio Lamborghini to start his own automobile company? Was it a Ferrari? A BMW, Alfa Romeo, or Volkswagen? And just think about that for a second, and we'll answer it at the end of the episode. So yeah, what was it that turned Lamborghini from a tractor-making entity into a supercar-making entity? We'll come back to that. A friend of mine wrote us a question on Facebook, and I have asked for some help from the Texas Department of Public Safety. What he said was that the interstate between Austin and San Antonio is an 85 mile an hour speed limit interstate. And I think
you can move there.
Is it an interstate or is it a highway?
An interstate is a type of highway, but yes, it is Interstate 35 that goes through there.
Okay. And, you know, he says that means that with the two cities being roughly 80 miles apart, that you could now drive from San Antonio to Austin in an hour. And so his question was, what's the fastest that anyone has ever done that trip and more importantly, verified by a third party? So what I did is I searched around online, of course, to see if I could find anybody talking about that run. Could not. And then I called the Texas Department of Public Safety after we had our own little sideline chat about it. And they actually acknowledged the email, but they haven't gotten back to me with an actual answer yet. So I'm hoping... Huh. That they'll say that they have, you know, I mean, realistically, what's the DPS going to say? They're going to say, yeah, we arrested someone doing 200 miles an hour on the interstate.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know who would be able to actually third party confirm a super fast run between those two cities anyway. It's not like someone sitting there with a stopwatch watching everybody go by.
Right. And you don't record what your speedometer says, and you don't admit publicly to a speed limit greater than that is posted.
Right.
The problem is if you give your actual minutes, I guess you can calculate. I don't know. There are certain things you don't do, and you can still maybe find a way.
Well, plus that Ben was saying something about the interstate itself. It's not like it's wide open Texas road with tumbleweeds, right, Ben?
Right. I've been there. This is, these are both good sized cities. I've got a lot of suburbs. This run of I-35 is not remote and desolate by any stretch to the imagination. There's civilization along most of it. So between the suburban flow and everything else, I mean, yeah, you might be clocked in the middle going 200 miles an hour, but you're not going to go that fast near the ends unless it's 3 a.m. or something. But, they probably have given a ticket to or probably arrested somebody who went through there going 180 on a crotch rocket motorcycle at 3 a.m. at some point.
Right. And that's what I'm hoping DPS will chime in and say is that, here's some of the record holders that they have, which unfortunately won't answer our friend's question.
Right.
We're never going to be able to confirm who's done that trip the fastest with any sort of third party.
Well, that's the other part of it because, a speeding ticket is only going to be that moment in time. It's not the time for the whole distance.
Right. Right.
And the thing that kind of amazes me, and I looked up speed limits to check this. I thought that 85 sounded a little extreme, but no, it's true. It is there. It's the only place in the interstate system that does have 85, and it's the highest in the system.
Right.
Why?
That was a highway over an interstate system that would be more likely to have the higher or more free speed limits.
Well, there used to be a road in the Dakotas somewhere.
I was trying to remember the one where there was no speed limit.
The sign said safe and prudent, and they got rid of that a while back.
Oh.
Now, there are some places in some of the more remote regions like West Texas and the Dakotas and Wyoming where there are some 75s and 80s, but the fact that the 85 isn't in those kind of places is what surprised me.
Right.
So I have to wonder what the state of Texas's rationale was for putting that there.
Go ahead, Becca.
Sorry, no, that's part of the problem with video. We can't always see. And a lot of people haven't noticed here in the Atlanta area. I knew it was coming, though, because it was posted in the local Cherokee County newspaper that 575 is now 70 miles per hour.
Oh, nice.
And I don't know if this counts or not, and this was long enough ago. Nobody could ever ask me questions and get me in trouble. Does it count? For those people that know the Atlanta and Georgia area, I got from the north end of the perimeter of Atlanta to Savannah in under 3 hours.
Oh, nice.
That's an impressive drive.
Does that count?
Yeah, that counts. Well, I want to back up for a second and say that if any of our listeners have any information about that San Antonio-Austin drive and can help us shed some more light on how fast it's ever been done, we would love to hear from you or just tell us your stories about what that drive is like. We would still love to hear from you.
I wonder if those rich guys in the Mercedes went through there when they did their coast to coast run recently.
I wonder. That's exactly the thought I had in mind. It's like, did those people in that specially modified thing, did they do that? But we'll never know. All right, we're almost out of time. I'm going to go ahead and answer the trivia question, and then we'll circle back and get ready for our next week's recording.
Okay.
The answer to the trivia question. The question was, what kind of car inspired Ferruccio Lamborghini to start his own automobile company? Was it a Volkswagen? Was it an Alfa Romeo? Was it a BMW? Or was it a Ferrari? Ben, you want to take a guess?
I would say Ferrari.
Becca, what do you think?
I'm kind of leaning towards Alfa Romeo.
Why are you leaning towards Alfa Romeo?
I don't know.
Ben, why are you thinking Ferrari?
Well, I've read the story, and while the actual brand doesn't stick out in memory, it seems like it would be a Ferrari kind of thing. Mr. Lamborghini was very successful at the tractor business. He made a lot of money. He bought a fancy sports car, and it proved to be just completely failing to meet his expectations. I can't remember if it was quality or performance or a little of both, but right. He was pretty upset about it. Went to go see the boss where the thing was made, who basically told him to go pound sand. So,
right. So that's essentially correct. So Ben has the correct answer. It was a Ferrari. And the way the story was told, the way I read it in preparation for this trivia question, it says Ferruccio famously owned a Ferrari 250 GT, which he repeatedly took in to be serviced at the Maranello headquarters because of a faulty clutch. When he politely asked Enzo Ferrari for a replacement part, Ferrari replied, "You're just a silly tractor manufacturer. How could you possibly know anything about sports cars?" And like any red-blooded Italian, he then spat on the floor, walked out, and started designing his own sports car.
And engineering is engineering.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, you know, we could sit here and weigh the two against each other in terms of sport car companies there. You know, recent Lamborghinis and recent Ferraris are not without their own sets of serious faults. But I wouldn't mind if someone put one in my driveway to, you know, to tool around in for a little while.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's it. Anybody got any other last minute things before we wrap this call?
I got nothing.
All right. I can't think of anything. I'm sitting here perusing over the corporate information on Harbor Freight just to see what I can find. I didn't realize they were headquartered in California.
Right. Right. Well, let's call that a day then. Thank you, as always, to our listeners for joining us for this episode of The Thing About Cars. Your 5-star ratings on our show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, I guess that's the same thing, and Spotify, wherever you listen to our show, please rate us. That makes us more searchable, and we really appreciate it when you tell your friends and family about us. And if you like what we do, you can support us via Patreon. A little bit goes a long way to helping us get more equipment, and in this case, probably even more airtime. We can pay for the Zoom subscription and do more with that. As always, be safe out there. We'll see you again in about a week.
Bye.
Later on.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.